Chapter 13. Elements as Money. Zinc, gold, tellurium, europium, aluminium. If the periodic table has a history with politics, it has an even longer and cozier relationship with money. The stories of many metallic elements cannot be told without getting tangled up in the history of money, which means the history of all those elements is also tangled up with the history of counterfeiting. In different centuries, cattle, spices, porpoise teeth, salt, cocoa beans, cigarettes, beetle legs, and tulips have all passed for currency, none of which can be faked convincingly. Metals are easier to doctor. Transition metals especially have similar chemistries and densities because they have similar electron structures, and they can blend together and replace one another in alloys. Different combinations of precious and less than precious metals have been fooling people for millennia. Around 700 BC, a prince named Midas inherited the kingdom of Phrygia in what is now Turkey. According to various myths, which might conflate two rulers named Midas, he led an eventful life. Jealous Apollo, the god of music, asked Midas to judge a showdown between him and the other great lyre-strummers of the era, then turned Midas's ears into donkey ears when Midas favored someone else over Apollo. He didn't deserve human ears if he judged music that badly. Midas also reportedly maintained the best rose garden in the ancient world. Scientifically, Midas sometimes receives credit for discovering tin, not true though it was mined in his kingdom, and for discovering the minerals black lead, graphite, and white lead, a beautiful bright white, poisonous lead pigment. Of course, no one would remember Midas today if not for another metallurgical novelty, his golden touch. He earned it after tending to the drunken satyr Silenus, who passed out in his rose garden one night. Silenus so appreciated the monarch's hospitality that he offered Midas a reward. Midas asked that whatever he touched transform into gold, a delight that soon cost him his daughter when he hugged her and almost cost him his life, since, for a time, even food transubstantiated into gold at his lips. Obviously, none of that probably ever happened to the real king, but there's evidence that Midas earned his legendary status for a good reason. It all traces back to the Bronze Age, which began in Midas's neighborhood around 3000 BC. Casting bronze, an alloy of tin and copper, was the high-tech field of the day, and although the metal remained expensive, the technology had penetrated most kingdoms by the time of Midas' reign. The skeleton of a king popularly called Midas, but proved later to be his father, Gordias, was found in its tomb in Phrygia, surrounded by bronze cauldrons and handsome bronze bowls with inscriptions, and the otherwise naked skeleton itself was found wearing a bronze belt. But in saying bronze, we need to be more specific. It's not like water, where two parts hydrogen always combine with one part oxygen. A number of different alloys with different ratios of metals all count as bronze, and bronze metals around the ancient world differed in color depending on the percentages of tin, copper, and other elements where the metals were mined. One unique feature of the metallic deposits near Phrygia was the abundance of ores with zinc. Zinc and tin ores commonly commingle in nature, and deposits of one metal can easily be mistaken for the other. What's interesting is that zinc mixed with copper doesn't form bronze, it forms brass. And the earliest known brass foundries existed in, of all places, the part of Asia Minor where Midas once reigned. Is it obvious yet? Go find something bronze and something brass and examine them. The bronze is shiny, but with overtones of copper. You wouldn't mistake it for anything else. The shine of brass is more alluring, more subtle, a little more golden. Midas's touch, then, was possibly nothing more than an accidental touch of zinc in the soils of his corner of Asia Minor. To test that theory, in 2007, a professor of metallurgy at Ankara University in Turkey and a few historians constructed a primitive Midas-era furnace into which they loaded local ores. They melted them, poured the resulting liquid into molds, and let it cool. Mirabile dictu, it hardened into an uncannily golden bullion. Naturally, it's impossible to know whether the contemporaries of King Midas believed that his precious zinc-laden bowls and statues and belts were actually gold. But they weren't necessarily the ones making up legends about him. More probably, the Greek travelers who later colonized that region of Asia Minor simply grew smitten with the Phrygian bronzes, so much brighter than their own. The tales they sent home could have swelled century by century, until golden-hued brass transmuted into real gold, and a local hero's earthly power transmuted into the supernatural power to create precious metals at a touch. After that, it took only the genius of Ovid to touch up the story for his Metamorphoses, and voila, a myth with a more than plausible origin. An even deeper archetype in human culture than Midas is the lost city of gold, of travelers in far-off alien lands stumbling into unimaginable wealth. El Dorado. In modern and slightly more realistic times, this dream often takes the form of gold rushes. Anyone who paid an iota of attention in history class knows that real gold rushes were awful, dirty, dangerous affairs with bears and lice and mine collapses and lots of pathetic whoring and gambling, and the chances that a person would end up rich were almost zilch. Yet almost no one with an iota of imagination hasn't dreamed of throwing over everything in his humdrum life and rushing off to prospect for a few pure nuggets. The desire for a great adventure and the love of riches are practically built into human nature. As such, history is dotted with innumerable gold rushes. Nature, naturally, doesn't want to part with her treasure so easily, so she invented iron pyrite, iron disulfide, to thwart amateur prospectors. Perversely, iron pyrite shines with a luster more golden than real gold, like cartoon gold or gold in the imagination. And more than a few greenhorns and people blinded by greed have been taken in during a fool's gold rush. But in all of history, probably the most confounded gold rush ever took place in 1896 on rough frontier land in the Australian outback. If iron pyrite is faux gold, then this gold rush in Australia, which eventually found desperate prospectors knocking down their own chimneys with pickaxes and sifting through the rubble, was perhaps the first stampede in history caused by fool's gold. Three Irishmen, including Patrick Paddy Hannon, were traversing the outback in 1893 when one of their horses lost a shoe 20 miles from home. It might have been the luckiest breakdown in history. Within days, without having to dig an inch into the dirt, they'd collected 8 pounds of gold nuggets just walking around. Honest but dim, the trio filed a claim with territory officials, which put the location on public record. Within a week, hundreds of prospectors were storming Hannon's find, as the post became known, to try their luck. In a way, the expanse was easy pickings. During those first months in the desert, gold was more plentiful than water. But while that sounds great, it wasn't. You can't drink gold, and as more and more miners piled in, the prices of supplies soared, and competition for mining sites grew fierce. People started having to dig for gold, and some fellows figured out there was easier money to be had in building up a real town instead. Breweries and brothels popped up in Hannon's find, as did houses and even paved roads. For bricks, cement, and mortar, builders collected the excess rock dug out during excavations. Miners just cast it aside, and as long as they were going to keep digging, there was nothing better to do with the rubble. Or so they assumed. Gold is an aloof metal. You won't find it mixed inside minerals and ores because it doesn't bond with other elements. Its flakes and nuggets are usually pure, besides a few odd alloys. The exception, the single element that will bond to gold, is tellurium, a vampirish element first isolated in Transylvania in 1782. Tellurium combines with gold to form some garish-sounding minerals, crannerite, petzite, sylvanite, and calverite, with some equally atrocious chemical formulas. instead of nice proportions such as H2O and CO2, krennerite is the sum of Au.8, Ag.02, multiplied by Te2. Those tellurides vary in color, too, and one of them, calaverite, shines sort of yellow. Actually, it shines more like brass or iron pyrite than deep-hued gold, but it's probably close enough to trick you if you've been out in the sun all day. You can imagine a raw, dirty 18-year-old hauling in calaverite nuggets to the local appraiser in Hannon's Find, only to hear the appraiser dismiss them as a sackful of what mineralogists classify as bag o' shite. Remember, too, that some tellurium compounds, not calaverite, but others, smell pungent, like garlic magnified 1,000 times, an odor notoriously difficult to get rid of. Better to sell it and bury it in roads where it won't stink and get back to digging for the real McCoy. But people just kept piling in to Hannon's Find, and food and water didn't get any cheaper. At one point, tensions over supplies ran so high that a full-on riot erupted. And as things got desperate, rumors circulated about that yellowish tellurium rock they were digging up and throwing away. Even if hardscrabble miners weren't acquainted with calaverite, geologists had been for years and knew its properties. For one, it decomposes at low temperatures, which makes separating out the gold darn easy. Calaverite had first been found in Colorado in the 1860s. Author's note: the fact that gold tellurium compounds were discovered in the mountains of Colorado is reflected in the name of a local mining town, Telluride, Colorado. Historians suspect that campers who'd built a fire one night noticed that, the rocks they'd ringed the fire pit with were oozing gold. Pretty soon, stories to that effect made their way to Hannon's Find. Hell finally broke loose on May 29, 1896. Some of the calaverite used to build Hannon's Find contained 500 ounces of gold per ton of rock, and miners were soon tearing out every damn ounce they could find. People attacked refuse heaps first, scrabbling among them for discarded rock. When those were picked clean, they went after the town itself. Paved over potholes became potholes again. Sidewalks were chiseled out. And you can bet the miner who built the chimney and hearth for his new home out of gold telluride-infused brick wasn't too sentimental about tearing it apart again. In later decades, the region around Hannon's Find, soon renamed Kalgoorlie, became the world's largest gold producer. The Golden Mile, they called it, and Kalgoorlie bragged that its engineers outpaced the rest of the world when it came to extracting gold from the ground. Seems like the later generations learned their lesson, not to be throwing aside rocks all willy-nilly after their father's fool's gold rush. Midas's zinc and Kalgoorlie's tellurium were rare cases of unintentional deception. Two innocent moments in monetary history surrounded by eons of deliberate counterfeiting. A century after Midas, the first real money, coins made of natural silver-gold alloy called electrum, appeared in Lydia, in Asia Minor. Shortly after that, another fabulously wealthy ruler, the Lydian king Croesus, figured out how to separate electrum into silver and gold coins, in the process establishing a real currency system. And within a few years of Croesus' feat, in 540 BC, King Polycrates, on the Greek isle Samos, began buying off his enemies in Sparta with lead slugs plated with gold. Ever since then, counterfeiters have used elements such as lead, copper, tin, and iron the way cheap barkeeps use water in kegs of beer, to make the real money stretch a little further. Today, counterfeiting is considered a straight case of fraud, but for most of history, a kingdom's precious metal currency was so tied up with its economic health that kings considered counterfeiting a high crime. Treason. Those convicted of such treason faced hanging, if not worse. Counterfeiting has always attracted people who do not understand opportunity costs. The basic economic law that you can make far more money plying an honest trade than spending hundreds of hours making free money. Nevertheless, it has taken some brilliant minds to thwart those criminals and design anything approaching foolproof currency. For instance, long after Isaac Newton had derived the laws of calculus and his monumental theory of gravity, he became master of the Royal Mint of England in the last few years of the 1600s. Newton, in his early 50s, just wanted a well-paying government post, but to his credit, he didn't approach it as a sinecure. Counterfeiting, especially clipping coins by shaving the edges and melting the scraps together to make new coins, was endemic in the seedier parts of London. The great Newton found himself entangled with spies, lowlifes, drunkards, and thieves, an entanglement he thoroughly enjoyed. A pious Christian, Newton prosecuted the wrongdoers he uncovered with the wrath of the Old Testament God, refusing pleas for clemency. He even had one notorious but slippery coiner, William Challoner, who'd goaded Newton for years with accusations of fraud at the mint, hanged and publicly disemboweled. The counterfeiting of coins dominated Newton's tenure, but not long after he resigned, the world financial system faced new threats from fake paper currency. A Mongol emperor in China, Kublai Khan, had introduced paper money there in the 1200s. The innovation spread quickly in Asia at first, partly because Kublai Khan executed anyone who refused to use it, but only intermittently in Europe. Still, by the time the Bank of England began issuing paper notes in 1694, the advantages of paper currency had grown obvious. The ores for making coins were expensive, coins themselves were cumbersome, and the wealth based on them depended too much on unevenly distributed mineral resources. Coins also, since knowledge of metalworking was more widespread in centuries past, were easier for most people to counterfeit than paper money. Nowadays, the situation is vice versa. Anyone with a laser printer can make a decent $20 bill. Do you have a single acquaintance who could cast a passable nickel, even if such a thing were worth doing? If the alloy-friendly chemistry of metal coins once favored swindlers, in the age of paper money, the unique chemistry of metals like europium helps government combat swindling. It all traces back to the chemistry of europium, especially the movement of electrons within its atoms. So far, we've discussed only electron bonds, the movement of electrons between atoms. But electrons constantly whirl around their own nuclei, too. Movement often compared to planets circling a sun. Although that's a pretty good analogy, it has a flaw if taken literally. Earth, in theory, could have ended up on many different orbits around the sun. Electrons cannot take any old path around a nucleus. They move within shells at different energy levels, and because there's no energy level between 1 and 2, or 2 and 3, and so on, the paths of electrons are highly circumscribed. They orbit only at certain distances from their sun and orbit in oblong shapes at funny angles. Also, unlike a planet, an electron, if excited by heat or light, can leap from its low-energy shell to an empty, high-energy shell. The electron cannot stay in the high-energy state for long, for it soon crashes back down. But this isn't a simple back-and-forth motion, because as it crashes, the electron jettisons energy by emitting light. The color of the emitted light depends on the relative heights of the starting and ending energy levels. A crash between closely spaced levels, such as 1 and 2, releases a pulse of low-energy, reddish light, while a crash between more widely spaced levels, say 5 and 2, releases high-energy, purple light. Because the electron's options about where to jump are limited to whole-number energy levels, the emitted light is also constrained. Light emitted by electrons in atoms is not like the white light from a light bulb. Instead, electrons emit light of very specific, very pure colors. Each element's shells sit at different heights, so each element releases characteristic bands of color, the very bands Robert Bunsen observed with his burner and spectroscope. Later, the realization that electrons jump to whole-number levels and never orbit at fractional levels was a fundamental insight of quantum mechanics. Everything wacky you've ever heard about quantum mechanics derives directly or indirectly from these discontinuous leaps. Europium can emit light as described, but not very well, and its brother lanthanides don't absorb incoming light or heat efficiently. Another reason chemists had trouble identifying them for so long. But light is an international currency, redeemable in many forms in the atomic world, and lanthanides can emit light in a way other than simple absorption. It's called fluorescence, which is familiar to most people from black lights and psychedelic posters. Author's note: to clarify some easily and often confused terms, luminescence is the umbrella term for a substance absorbing and emitting light. Fluorescence is the instantaneous process described in this chapter. Phosphorescence is similar to fluorescence. It consists of molecules absorbing high-frequency light and emitting low-frequency light, but phosphorescing molecules absorb light like a battery and continue to glow long after the light shuts off. Obviously, both fluorescence and phosphorescence derive from elements on the periodic table, fluorine and phosphorus, the two most prominent elements in the molecules that first exhibited these traits to chemists. In general, normal emissions of light involve just electrons, but fluorescence involves whole molecules. And whereas electrons absorb and emit light of the same color, yellow in, yellow out, fluorescent molecules absorb high-energy light, ultraviolet light, but emit that energy as lower-energy, visible light. Depending on the molecule it's attached to, europium can emit red, green, or blue light. That versatility is a bugbear for counterfeiters and makes europium a great anti-counterfeiting tool. The European Union, EU, in fact, uses its eponymous element in the ink on its paper bills. To prepare the ink, EU Treasury chemists lace a fluorescing dye with europium ions, which latch onto one end of the dye molecules. No one really knows which dyes, since the EU has reportedly outlawed looking into it. Law-abiding chemists can only guess. Despite the anonymity, chemists know the europium dyes consist of two parts. First is the receiver, or antenna, which forms the bulk of the molecule. The antenna captures incoming light energy, which europium cannot absorb, transforms it into vibrational energy, which europium can absorb, and wriggles that energy down to the molecule's tip. There, the europium stirs up its electrons, which jump to higher energy levels. But just before the electrons jump and crash and emit, a bit of the incoming wave of energy bounces back into the antenna. That wouldn't happen with isolated europium atoms, but here the bulky part of the molecule dampens the energy and dissipates it. Because of that loss, when electrons crash back down, they produce lower energy light. So why is that shift useful? The fluorescing dyes are selected so that europium appears dull under visible light, and a counterfeiter might be lulled into thinking he has a perfect replica. Slide a Euronote beneath a special laser, though, and the laser will tickle the invisible ink. The paper itself goes black, but small, randomly oriented fibers laced with europium pop out like party-colored constellations. The charcoal sketch of Europe on the bills glows green, as it might look to alien eyes from space. A pastel wreath of stars gains a corona of yellow or red, and monuments and signatures and hidden seals shine royal blue. Officials nab counterfeits simply by looking for bills that don't show all these signs. There are really two euros on each banknote, then, the one we see day to day, and a second, hidden euro mapped directly onto the first, an embedded code. This effect is extremely hard to fake without professional training, and the europium dyes, in tandem with other security features, make the euro the most sophisticated piece of currency ever devised. Euro banknotes certainly haven't stopped counterfeiting. That's probably impossible as long as people like holding cash, but in the periodic table-wide struggle to slow it down, europium has taken a place among the most precious metals. Despite all the counterfeiting, many elements have been used as legitimate currency throughout history. Some, such as antimony, were a bust. Others became money under gruesome circumstances. While working in a prison chemical plant during World War II, the Italian writer and chemist Primo Levi began stealing small sticks of cerium. Cerium sparks when struck, making it an ideal flint for cigarette lighters, and he traded the sticks to civilian workers in exchange for bread and soup. Levi came into the concentration camps fairly late, nearly starved there, and began bartering with cerium only in November 1944. He estimated that it bought him 2 months' worth of rations, of life, enough to last until the Soviet Army liberated his camp in January 1945. His knowledge of cerium is why we have his post-Holocaust masterpiece, The Periodic Table, today. Other proposals for elemental currency were less pragmatic and more eccentric. Glenn Seaborg, caught up in nuclear enthusiasm, once suggested that plutonium would become the new gold in world finance because it's so valuable for nuclear applications. Perhaps as a send-up of Seaborg, a science fiction writer once suggested that radioactive waste would be a better currency for global capitalism, since coins stamped from it would certainly circulate quickly. And of course, during every economic crisis, people bellyache about reverting to a gold or silver standard. Most countries considered paper bills the equivalent of actual gold or silver until the 20th century, and people could freely trade the paper for the metal. Some literary scholars think that L. Frank Baum's 1900 book, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, whose Dorothy wore silver, not ruby, slippers, and traveled on a gold-colored brick road to a cash-green city, was really an allegory about the relative merits of the silver versus the gold standard. However antiquated a metals-based economy seems, such people have a point. Although metals are quite illiquid, the metals markets are one of the most stable long-term sources of wealth. It doesn't even have to be gold or silver. Ounce by ounce, the most valuable element among the elements that you can actually buy is rhodium. That's why, to trump a mere platinum record, the Guinness Book of Records gave former Beatle Paul McCartney a disc made of rhodium in 1979 to celebrate his becoming the best-selling musician of all time. But no one ever made more money more quickly with an element on the periodic table than the American chemist Charles Hall did with aluminium. A number of brilliant chemists devoted their careers to aluminium throughout the 1800s, and it's hard to judge whether the element was better or worse off afterward. A Danish chemist and a German chemist simultaneously extracted this metal from the ancient astringent alum around 1825. Alum is the powder cartoon characters like Sylvester the Cat sometimes swallow that makes their mouth pucker. Because of its luster, mineralogists immediately classified aluminium as a precious metal, like silver or platinum, worth hundreds of dollars an ounce. 20 years later, a Frenchman figured out how to scale up these methods for industry, making aluminium available commercially for a price. It was still more expensive than even gold. That's because, despite being the most common metal in the Earth's crust, around 8% of it by weight, hundreds of millions of times more common than gold, aluminium never appears in pure, mother-lodal form. It's always bonded to something, usually oxygen. Pure samples were considered miracles. The French once displayed Fort Knox-like aluminium bars next to their crown jewels, and the minor emperor Napoleon III reserved a prized set of aluminium cutlery for special guests at banquets. Less favored guests used gold knives and forks. In the United States, government engineers, to show off their country's industrial prowess, capped the Washington Monument with a 6-pound pyramid of aluminium in 1884. A historian reports that 1 ounce of shavings from the pyramid would have paid a day's wages for each of the laborers who erected it. Aluminium's 60-year reign as the world's most precious substance was glorious. But soon, an American chemist ruined everything. The metal's properties, light, strong, attractive, tantalized manufacturers, and its omnipresence in the Earth's crust had the potential to revolutionize metal production. It obsessed people, but no one could figure out an efficient way to separate it from oxygen. At Oberlin College in Ohio, chemistry professor named Frank Fanning Jewett would regale his students with tales of the aluminium El Dorado that awaited whoever mastered this element, and at least one of his students had the naivete to take his professor seriously. In his later years, Professor Jewett bragged to old college chums that my greatest discovery was the discovery of a man, Charles Hall. Hall worked with Jewett on separating aluminium throughout his undergraduate years at Oberlin. He failed and failed and failed again, but failed a little more smartly each time. Finally, in 1886, Hall ran an electric current from handmade batteries, power lines didn't exist, through a liquid with dissolved aluminium compounds. The energy from the current zapped and liberated the pure metal, which collected in minute silver nuggets on the bottom of the tank. The process was cheap and easy, and it would work just as well in huge vats as on the lab bench. This had been the most sought-after chemical prize since the Philosopher's Stone, and Hall had found it. The aluminium boy wonder was just 23. Hall's fortune, however, was not made instantly. Chemist Paul Erol in France stumbled on more or less the same process at the same time. Today, Hall and Erol share credit for the discovery that crashed the aluminium market. An Austrian invented another separation method in 1887, and with the competition bearing down on Hall, he quickly founded what became the Aluminum Company of America, or Alcoa, in Pittsburgh. It turned into one of the most successful business ventures in history. Aluminium production at Alcoa grew at exponential rates. In its first months in 1888, Alcoa eked out 50 pounds of aluminium per day. 2 decades later, it had to ship 88,000 pounds per day to meet the demand. And while production soared, prices plummeted. Years before Hall was born, one man's breakthrough had dropped aluminium from $550 per pound to $18 per pound in 7 years. 50 years later, not even adjusting for inflation, Hall's company drove down the price to 25 cents per pound. Such growth has been surpassed probably only one other time in American history, during the silicon semiconductor revolution 80 years later, and like our latter-day computer barons, Hall cleaned up. Author's note. Moore's law says that the number of silicon transistors on a microchip will double every 18 months. Amazingly, it has held true since the 1960s. Had the law held for aluminium, Alcoa would have been producing 400,000 pounds of aluminium per day within 2 decades of starting up, not just 88,000. So aluminium did well, but not quite well enough to beat its neighbor on the periodic table. At his death in 1914, he owned Alcoa shares worth $30 million, around $650 million today. Author's note, there's some discrepancy about the magnitude of Charles Hall's wealth at his death. $30 million is the high end of the range. The confusion may be because Hall died in 1914, but his estate was not settled until 14 years later. One-third of his estate went to Oberlin College. And thanks to Hall, aluminium became the utterly blasé metal we all know, the basis for pop cans and pinging Little League bats and airplane bodies. A little anachronistically, it still sits atop the Washington Monument, too. I suppose it depends on your taste and temperament whether you think aluminium was better off as the world's most precious or most productive metal. Incidentally, I use the international spelling, aluminium, instead of the strictly American, aluminum, throughout this book. This spelling disagreement traces its roots back to the rapid rise of this metal. When chemists in the early 1800s speculated about the existence of element 13, they used both spellings, but eventually settled on the extra I. That spelling paralleled the recently discovered barium, magnesium, sodium, and strontium. When Charles Hall applied for patents on his electric current process, he used the extra I, too. However, when advertising his shiny metal, Hall was looser with his language. There's debate about whether cutting the eye was intentional or a fortuitous mistake on advertising flyers, but when Hall saw aluminum, he thought it a brilliant coinage. He dropped the vowel permanently and with it a symbol, which aligned his product with classy platinum. His new metal caught on so quickly and grew so economically important that aluminum became indelibly stamped on the American psyche. As always in the United States, money talks.